Hello and welcome to the official EFL podcast. Second spot in League One and holding their own amongst former Premier League teams. Oxford United boss Liam Manning joins us.
I think I've quite clear strengths and weaknesses. I'm over analytical and I over reflect and over analyse everything, which again, like I say, I think is a big strength, but can also, you know, sometimes become a bit of a weakness, which is why I've got a great group of staff sometimes where they're going like park it, move on, which I think is also equally important in this division when you know the relentless nature of it.
Sky Sports' David Stowell, yes, that's his full name, co-host once again, and we're back with 72 in 72. Blackburn's Andrew Moran is this week's contestant. Welcome once again to the official EFL podcast. So then, welcome along to the latest edition of the official EFL podcast. David Stowell is back on co-hosting duties. Look at his lovely smiley face. David, it's a pleasure to see you again, my friend. Let's get stuck into what we're chatting about this week. Let me just give you a quick roundup of the Carabao Cup. In midweek, obviously, there's games to come. Exeter lost to Borough. I mean, kudos to Borough fans. They played Exeter. They've got Plymouth at the weekend. Exeter was a 669-mile round trip. Plymouth is a 752-mile round trip. But all reports are saying that both away ends are sold out. So, Borough fans, I absolutely salute you. Port Vale, they progress at the expense of Mansfield Town. The Stags' first defeat this season. I mean, it feels like an age since we saw a Mansfield Town suffer defeat. As at the time of recording, West Ham faced Arsenal. Bournemouth take on Liverpool. Chelsea are against Blackburn. It's Everton, Burnley, Ipswich, Fulham. And in a repeat of last year's final, Man United take on Newcastle United. Stowley, let's get stuck into the Championship now that we've done the Carabao Cup. Managerial changes. We've got Gareth Ainsworth moving on from QPR. We've got Nigel Pearson, the second longest serving, well, he was in the Championship, moving on from Bristol City. Let's take them both separately. Surprises with either? Was any on the cards for you?
Not surprised with Queen's Park Rangers. It just didn't seem to, results-wise at least, it wasn't working. 5 wins from 28 games in charge for Gareth. And having had 11 years at Wickham and been so successful there, he obviously tried to come to Queen's Park Rangers. Everyone was sort of, or a lot of people were clamouring for him to be given the chance at Queen's Park Rangers. And clearly it was something he couldn't turn down. It was something that the club didn't want to pass over. But it just didn't really work. And it's a shame for Gareth that, because he did so well at Wickham and he's been so good at the man management side of the game and all the rest of it. It just didn't click at Loftus Road, which is a real shame for the club as well, because there's been a lot of potential at Queen's Park Rangers for a while, but it just hasn't quite turned into anything. 6 straight defeats, and now they've turned to a relatively, in this country, unknown figure. What's interesting for me is you look at the last few managers at Queen's Park Rangers, and there have been various contrasting styles of play, which has perhaps been difficult, I mean, you'll know more than me, for the players there to suddenly say, one minute, right, we're going to coach you to play this way, and then that person gets moved on and it's right now you're going to learn to play this way, whether it's playing out from the back or long ball or whatever, and that must be quite difficult, and it's obviously led to the club not really going anywhere, which is a real shame from the outside looking in, because you want to see a club like that doing well and competing rather than struggling and going in the wrong direction.
Marty Cifuentes, you say we don't know too much about him. I think, don't worry, I'm not going to ask you for chapter and verse. Like you said, that different direction, different expectations. What do you think?
Well, a very experienced man in terms of managing around Europe. Interesting that his first game in charge is going to be against Rotherham. So that's a key battle.
Huge battle at the bottom, isn't it?
In the Championship, because there are so many teams down there and those two sides obviously struggling hugely. It's interesting just to see that he's very settled with a back four, the way he plays. So it's unlikely that we're going to see too much movement from a 3 to a 4 and back again. But he is able to change things during games. And I think he's quite big on the people side of things, being open with his players. So it should be quite a ride for Queen's Park Rangers fans, but obviously the start is crucial. If you don't start well as a manager, straight away you're on the back foot with fans, with social media, with media generally. So, you know, we wish him all the best and see what happens.
Never get a second chance at a first impression, do you? Nigel Pearson's left Bristol City. His statement on Twitter or X, whichever way you want to go about referencing that platform, very open-hearted, very, very magnanimous in the decision made for him to move on. There was a bit of consternation in recent weeks about his contract situation. He was very forthcoming with that in post-match interviews. So maybe a touch of why underneath the reasoning of him moving on, do you reckon, Stowley?
Yeah, I think in the last few years, we've seen the value and the risk sometimes in what managers say in interviews. We saw it with Scott Parker, I think, when he lost the job at Fulham. Sometimes, depending on what you come out and say about the club or about the board, it can perhaps get you in hot water or make people change their opinions on the direction that they want to go in. He came out and said, "My position has not been secure, which irritates me," in an interview with the BBC. And I don't know whether that irritated the people at Bristol City. I don't have the inside track on that. But ultimately, his contract was due to expire at the end of this season anyway. So it may well have been that they've decided, looking at the position in the table, 15th in the Championship, 5 defeats in the last 7, that they've thought, we could wait till the summer, or we could bring someone in now. They've got a bit of time to get to know the squad. Then you've got the January window. And then who knows? As we both know, and everyone listening to this will know, you win 3 out of 4 in the Championship and you fly up that table. And Bristol City, you do the predictions. I look at them every week. I'm always interested to see whether you get them right or wrong. How on earth do you predict Bristol City's results? I mean, the last few seasons have been so difficult to call with them that, we, you know, right now, who knows where they're going to finish at the end of this season? Who knows where they're going to be in 5 years' time? It's really hard to call. So the appointment's going to be fascinating, and the next few weeks will be interesting to see where they go, and obviously the windows as well.
Thanks for having my back with those utterly, they're just awfully hard predictions. It's like herding cats. Elsewhere in the Championship, it's the first win for Sheffield Wednesday. They beat Rotherham. Then it was back to chats off the pitch with regards to ownership and the finances. I'm doing that in inverted commas. Moving on very, very quickly from that, Stowley. Leicester have made it 9 in a row. There's a blockbuster game between themselves and Leeds on Friday night. Right, into League One. Portsmouth came from behind to beat Reading. Reading, again, another club beset with protests. It's the Sell Before We Die fan group, who aren't too happy, of course, with their owner. A real show of force, of solidarity, of togetherness. But from a Reading point of view, you look at what's going on the pitch, starting the game very, very well, but then obviously that Pompey side with real fortitude, that's why they're top of that division. They can come from behind. They can put games right during the course of 90-plus minutes worth of football. It's a tough one because there's a lot of energy being focused on the things that I'm sure Reading fans just wish weren't there.
Yeah, and we covered Reading during the early part of the season, Reading against Cambridge. Did, yes. And I've watched quite a bit of, obviously we watch a lot of the EFL as we go along in the season, whether we're covering the teams or not. But having watched a fair bit of Reading this season, it's great that the only thing I'd sort of be heartened by if I were a Reading fan is the fact that it's a team of young players who are trying their best to find their way in the game. And they're digging in and they're doing the very best they can with the ability they've got, which is clearly they've got some ability there. But experience goes a long way in football, and not just the experience of numbers of games under your belt, but the emotional experience of it all.
Absolutely.
And you know, you look at that squad now with a few experienced players in there, but ultimately a young core. They are bottom of the table. They are 8 points adrift for various reasons, obviously the results, but also points deductions. And emotionally, that's got to be really difficult to handle, because you're trying to go out there and do the best you can. You've got all this noise around the club, and some of them they're properly learning on the job. And January, of course, other clubs will come in and say, well, we'll take him and we'll take him and we'll take him for relatively low fees, potentially, if Reading need the money desperately. It's a really sad time for them. I just hope it gets sorted out and they can get upwardly mobile at some point soon.
Amen to all of that. Oxford United beat Lincoln City. We're going to be speaking to their boss, Liam Manning, a very impressive, I say young manager, he might still be in his 30s, but my word, he's been managing for a very, very long time and coaching. On a very foggy night at Sinsel Bank, which really did buy into our Halloween. I don't know whether you're scared of Halloween, whether you're an embrace of Halloween. Are you a trick-or-treater, Stowley?
In my youth, yes. But now I'm more of a
ghost story
guy.
I should hope you're not doing it now, unless it's with children. Your own
well,
children, of
course. That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Right, let's move on from that. Derby County, back to winning ways. 4-0 winners against Northampton. Consternation in the Rams, not necessarily in their ranks, but with the last few weeks, with perhaps parts of how the season's going. As we talked about Reading having a young side, Derby County filled with experience, filled with players that have operated at higher levels. There was talk, perhaps, of Paul Warne moving on. Obviously, not by his own decision. They've categorically come out the ownership and said he's our man. We're moving forward with Paul Warne, which, as we know, Paul, we're all extremely happy about. But that was a big, big win and much needed.
Yeah, and when you sort of look at what Paul has said this week, and you know, we both know Paul very well. He's a very approachable guy, as someone covering matches and getting to chat with him, and obviously a very talented manager as well, as he's proved in the past with Rotherham, which it has generally been a tough job, but he's done it very well. But his comments, having had the backing of the owners, just sort of saying, we aren't the team we were. We're trying to build a new team. Mm-hmm. The expectation comes with the name Derby County, but actually, you kind of got to judge a team on where they are in the moment and physically where they are on the table. They're 2 points off the playoffs. You know, they're right in the mix. But obviously, the expectation is that they should be in the top two or top three and be flying back up into the Championship. The worrying thing for them is the consistency. Obviously, the win against Northampton was great, but before that, they lost to Stevenage, who were just above them in the table. They beat Exeter. Before that, they lost to Shrewsbury. It's that sort of win-loss, win-loss run that they're on. They've only got back-to-back league wins once, and that was in mid to late August against Fleetwood and Peterborough. So they need that consistency of results to really sort of push them up the table. And obviously, it's so tight in that division. It's ridiculously congested. So someone like Derby County with a few results back-to-back can really push on up.
So Paul Warne is there and cracking on with Derby County. Bristol Rovers have dispensed, of course, with Joey Barton's services. Never a dull moment with Joey. I mean, he leaves Bristol Rovers in 15th in League One. And I mean, the next port of call will be as intriguing as the last one. And all the old adages about keeping a good man down apply to this, because you know for a fact Joey Barton will be somewhere else very, very soon. Into League Two we go. At the top are Stockport, Notts County below them, Wrexham in third. Of course, Wrexham beat Notts at the weekend. They're now level on points, level on goal difference, level on games played. That could be pretty juicy. Mansfield lost in the cup, but they are still, of course, unbeaten in the league. Crewe, who I saw at Harrogate Town. And I tell you what, it's a club very, very local to me. I don't get there as often as I should do, because obviously I'm working. And again, working in inverted commas, busy in other places to cover another football. A wonderful setup, and they also do a cracking steak pie. So if you're ever in the area, get yourself there, not just for the pie, but the football as well. But the pie is one huge reason to go. Stockport, as I said, top of the division, 5 clear. All the chat, Stowley, and I'm as guilty of it as the next person when it comes to deliberating League Two, is about Notts County and about Wrexham. But we saw Stockport County in the playoffs last season. We saw them slowly shake that kind of feeling off at the start of this season, and now sitting very pretty, 5 clear at the top.
Yeah, that's right. And I did the playoff final, which they lost to Carlisle, which was a real rollercoaster ride of a season for them, but also the final itself. Looking at their form, I mean, I covered them recently against Wrexham, funnily enough, when they absolutely took them apart. Tanto Alafe was excellent, scored a hat-trick. Louis Barry, influential as well. Anthony Sasevic just pulling the strings in midfield. They won 5-0. It could have been 6 or 7. They didn't let Wrexham have a kick, really. They're now on a run of 11 wins in a row. I think it's 28 scored, 7 conceded and 5 clean sheets. I mean, astonishing stuff. That's league and Football League Trophy, of course. But 10 league matches in that run. And it's frightening. And this is what we're talking about, stringing wins together. If you can do that, you go flying. And they're sitting very pretty at the top. And you know, they're looking down at everyone else thinking, well, if we can just keep this form roughly going, you know, obviously you're not going to win every game between now and the end of the season. But I mean, they could go up again. And what would that be? 2 promotions in 3 years. Fantastic for the club and for the area as well.
Speaking of promotions and something that a club and a manager were synonymous with joining in at the same time together, Grimsby Town, Paul Hurst, of course, has moved on, alongside his assistant Chris Doig, who ironically I lived with Chris Doig when we were both trainees at Nottingham Forest in the late 90s. I'm sure it's something he's both had therapy for and would hate me for reminding him if he's listening. But again, so much success that we've seen Paul have with Grimsby, promotions, trips to Wembley. And given the recent history of what Grimsby Town have been, Stowley, I remember playing against Grimsby Town when they were in the second tier of English football with Nottingham Forest, and it was always a game that was keenly contested, well attended. It was also not too far from my where my grandparents lived in that part of Lincolnshire. One vivid memory of is my mum giving him a telling off because I miscontrolled the ball in the first 5 minutes, and his take on it was, "Oh God, he's having one of those games, is he?" Which I thought was very, very funny. The collective groans that came from the away end probably spoke the same volumes as my granddad's. But again, he's another manager that we've spent time with, that we've worked with. That's always been very honest and open with his approach to what he does with his teams. And again, it feels. There's a sadness to this, but results do speak, and progression of a football club is paramount with any decisions made. But what's your take on Paul moving on from Grimsby?
Well, I think you've summed it up brilliantly. You kind of look at it from a football fan's perspective, and if you kind of think through Grimsby Town eyes for a moment there, yeah, a lot of happiness has been had between manager and club. And the club itself, I mean... First thing to say about Grimsby Town is what an atmosphere on a match day. Incredible place to watch football. And you feel like you are part of the town when you're there and you're taking in the game, the atmosphere. I always think it's really sad when a manager who's so close to a club leaves, because there are a lot of managers in the game who are managers and they come to a club, and when it all ends, it's just a guy leaving a club, even if they've had success. But this felt more special than that. And those are sad days. We've seen quite a few of those, I think, over the past few years. Managers leaving clubs that mean an awful lot to them. And yeah, we'll see him again, no doubt, because he's had great success in the past, and he'll do so again. And Grimsby Town will rise again, no doubt as well. And as I say, on a match day, if you've never been, go, because it's quite a day.
I say it often on this podcast, but he is genuinely one of the good guys, and we wish Paul all the very best alongside Chris as well. Of course, my former landlord who charged me extortionate rent back in the late 90s. Obviously we'll see a return somewhere for Paul Hurst. I tell you who has returned, it's David Stowell. He's been wonderful so far in the first half of our official EFL podcast. Another thing that has come back after a month break is 72 in 72, and this week it's Blackburn's Andrew Moran.
My name's Andrew Moran, and this is 72 in 72. Leicester, Ipswich, Blackburn, Hull, Rotherham, Plymouth, QPR, Sheffield Wednesday, Leighton Orient, Northampton, Blackpool, Port Vale, Exeter, Preston, Leeds, Portsmouth, Gillingham, Colchester, Forest Green. Millwall, just trying to think of everyone we played.
Stop. You well, mate.
Not bad. So a score of 20 there for Blackburn's Andrew Moran, which puts him firmly in mid-table of our 72 in 72 league table. Let me just rattle that off for you now. At the top, Matt Smith. Second place, John Coleman. Mark Albrighton follows him. Liam Rossini is just above Andrew Moran in mid-table. Valerian Ishmael, Alfie May, Gary Rowett, Stuart Dallas. And at the bottom, but there's still time, of course, Aaron Ramsey. Right, that's our league table for that. And fresh from a trip to Lincoln and back to winning ways, it's Oxford United boss Liam Manning joining us now. They are second in the table. A very hard-fought 3 points, a very foggy 3 points. Liam, thanks for joining us. How was last night?
Yeah, no, it was a little bit nervy at about 70 minutes when the fog came down. I was a little bit anxious about the game staying on. So fortunately, we got through it. And I have to say, it was a really good performance from the lads. Really pleased with how we played. I thought it was a really professional away performance. Overall delighted to get the 3 points.
It gave it a real spooky Halloweeny feel, which from looking from a distance added to all to the drama. A goal from a set piece, which I'm sure absolutely delights coaches, head coaches, managers up and down the land. A goalkeeping error, of course, which helped seal the points. And a bit of pressure to withstand come the end. Is that what you mean by a very professional performance? Lots of boxes ticked for you last night.
Yeah, especially responding. Obviously, we've had a week where we've actually performed quite well, but not got the results that either we felt like we've deserved at times, or obviously clearly we've wanted. So I think it speaks volumes about the group how we bounced back last night. Like I said, we had an injury after about 5 minutes where we lost Sam Long, which we had to make a change, and we changed system with that, which again shows kind of where the lads are at in that they can quickly adjust in game. And it still looked like us, and the players still be clear on how we want it to look and how we want to play to get success. And then I thought second half I didn't really feel too much under threat, to be fair. I thought the players, you know, controlled spaces where we wanted to, and ultimately, you know, did what we needed to get the win.
Is that something you work on, Liam, in terms of losing players in game? I know a lot of managers work on what it would be like if you lost a player from a red card, for example, 10 against 11. But in terms of taking individual players out, how do you sort of prepare the team for that if it happens through an injury or something like that?
Yeah, I think it starts for us having real clarity on our identity. I think that's important. So we break the game down into phases of how we want to work. And we're very principle-driven, more so than systems. So, you know, when we're in block or, for example, the players know that we're happy to concede space in front and outside. And that whether we're in a 5-2-3, a 5-4-1, a 4-4-2, whatever that is, the principles are the same. Nothing comes through us. We control the space behind us and allow it in front of us. So I think, you know, that the fact we try and coach all the players, we don't just focus on starting lineups. We do try and make it quite clear for all the lads that, you know, when they step in, they know what their role is in the position they're playing. So I think that for me over the course of the season, knowing that we're going to need, you know, I think it was 34 players the club used last year. So when you've got that volume of players, you're going to need all of them to be quite clear on their roles when they step in. So that's the day to day. We do it on the training pitch. We do it through video. We do it through animation. There's so many different ways that we try and, you know, get them to soak up the information. And yeah, I think what we've got is a group that, you know, are really open to that, and at the minute have been really receptive.
Given the company that you're keeping in League One, Pompey at the top, yourselves in second, Bolton, Peterborough, Barnsley, Stevenage, and Derby down in seventh. If you were a League One layperson, you looked at that table, you see, as is the case, we discuss it a lot, former Premier League teams looking to get themselves out and promoted. The expectation that comes from Oxford United, is it realistic? Is it something internally that you are all very, very happy with? Because I know you're a thoroughly ambitious setup led by yourself.
Yeah, I also think the context of when we joined the club in March, where, you know, the position the club was in, I think... you know, it was a challenging end to the season. Obviously, a relegation battle. So to go for a relegation battle, and then, you know, it was quite a big overhaul at the club in the summer. You know, in terms of staff changes, we had 17 players out and 11 players in. And you know, you're not going to correct all of it and get it all right in one window. So the fact that, you know, I thought we had a good summer. Head of recruitment did a really good job. That, you know, the players that we brought in, we did, you know, a huge amount of work on. To complement what was already a really, you know, solid group of players that were already in the door. And then just things like processes and ways of working and the culture that we want to create, the training ground and the club. That stuff doesn't happen overnight. And to be fair, you know, we put a lot of hard graft in. There's no secret to it. It's a lot of hard work, a lot of hours. Yeah, terribly obsessive with it as well. Again, I think what that's
you
done
say
is
that I'm with a smile great. On your face, though. You enjoy it, I bet, don't you?
Yeah, I think I'm quite clear strengths and weaknesses. I'm over analytical, and I over reflect and over analyze everything, which again, like I say, I think is a big strength, but can also, you know, sometimes become a bit of a weakness, which is why I've got a great group of staff sometimes where they're going like park it, move on, which I think is also equally important in this division when, you know, the relentless nature of it.
Is that delegation important to you? Has it been important to you throughout your coaching career? Because you've been a coach for a long time for someone who is, you know, relatively young in the industry.
Yeah, thanks for that. Definitely. I think it takes a long time. I think obviously I had the advantage. I started coaching at 21, so I realised I wasn't going to play at a high level. I started coaching really young and was really fortunate, I think, with the grounding that I did have early on from, you know, some terrific mentors and also where the game was at, you know, pre-Treble P, you know, very few staff, so you kind of got exposed to everything, which, you know, I thought was a real blessing for me. But again, I think it takes a long time to, you know, create real clarity on your playing philosophy of how you want to play, but also coaching philosophy. And then for me, my you know, how I want to be elite as a leader. So I've done numerous courses, done, you know, practice it, got it right, got it wrong. But I think, you know, I'm quite clear now in terms of how I want to work. So again, for me, empowering staff and empowering players is a really big part of that, which, you know, it you know, there's a perception you just let people get on with it, which is definitely not the case. It's empowering people to, and understanding mistakes are part of that process. I think it's then a case of how do you manage that? How do you manage their mistakes to, you know, to allow people to grow, to keep motivation high, and again, that reinforces the culture that we want, which is a place where, irrespective of results, it's about developing, progressing, and getting better.
I think it really does reflect, and it's something that I've seen a sea change with over the last 25 years with regards to, we mentioned your age, Leo, and obviously in a very in a lovely way, because Stowley's like that, he's dead charming. I'm the horrible one on this podcast. but the point being that people say young managers, but when you've got nearly 20 years in the bank of coaching experience, I mean, vocationally, you look at perhaps another trodden path of a professional leaving the game at 35, 36 and going into coaching. I mean, you're at least a decade and a half ahead of people such as that with regards to what you've got under your belt, haven't you, really? With minutes on the pitch, minutes around players. So that term young manager only is literally reflecting the birth date. I mean, and because the minutes on the pitch far supersede many, many people that are getting into that side of the game, isn't it?
You definitely wouldn't think it with these bags under my eyes after last night.
That's why I'm staying well away from my camera, mate. I don't want to get any closer.
Yeah, it was a late one. Experience can be good and bad, right? I think it's all dependent on the person and how you use that experience. You know, if you've got the same experience for 20 years, you know, it doesn't potentially mean it's a good thing. If you've got, you know, 5 experiences over 20 years, you'll be a completely different coach and leader and person for it. So, again, I think it's how you use that experience. I know, again, that's where I feel fortunate that the hard, because there wasn't many full-time coaching jobs, the hard graft I did have to put in terms of I was 7 days a week working with development centres, under 8s, boys, girls, under 14s, watching the youth team during the day, you know, driving minibuses, doing kit. I think that they're the experiences which, again, I think links to, like I said earlier, around the fact that I'm quite a reflective person. I do kind of, you know, similar when I left MK, to be fair, my first thing is, right, why did it go wrong? What would I do differently? How do I go back in a better version of myself, ultimately? So again, I think that has to go hand in hand with experience. Otherwise, you know, years and years, that for me doesn't potentially mean anything. It's how do you use that experience, you know, to become the best version of you?
It sounds, I mean, it's very much that emphasis on the team, isn't it, and the collective. I know Marcus McGuane has been a player that's asserted himself and maybe changed perception, shall we say, with regards to his status within Oxford United. I know you're not a big fan of picking out individuals, but he seems to have been a key factor in what's gone on in the right way this season.
Yeah, I think I have a good relationship with Marcus, to be fair. And again, I think sometimes, especially where the world's at now, players and people can get misread. I think in terms of, you know, body language, how people carry themselves. And I think sometimes, and you know, I was fortunate, I think, for the experience I had at West Ham. You know, I think sometimes, you know, lads from London can be slightly different in terms of, you know, you rightly so, you sometimes have to work harder to get their respect and the trust of them. And again, I think that for me is really important, that, you know, if you want to help people, and that's ultimately part of the reason why I got into coaching. I love football, but I also love helping people. I love that side of it and seeing people, you know, develop and progress. So again, that's always the bit for me, is how do you develop that relationship where players will allow you in. And again, I think it's a two-way thing, right? The players have to want to and have to be receptive to it. But again, for me, is how do I adapt myself to make sure I can try and get the maximum out of somebody, which, again, is the, you know, probably having worked in development, that's the bit I find, you know, massively rewarding when you see somebody progress. So he's done brilliantly for us. And again, I think what's helped him is having competition with Cam Brannigan and Josh McEachran. I think, you know, when you look at it, you know, the three, you know, got Oshin Smith, who's a good player as well, but it's obviously not had much of a look in because of the level of those three. And again, I think that for me will get the best out of people as well. So I think it's the culture you create, the relationships you have with people, but then also what you've got in the building to, you know, so nobody can become complacent. People know that they have to be on, you know, on their maximum, on their A game to, you know, to nail down their position. And even then, we still make changes sometimes depending on what we need to get success in games.
So with that in mind, talking about the sort of team ethic, if you like, Liam, looking at your start to the season, obviously defeat on the opening weekend against Cambridge, then defeat in the League Cup to Bristol City. But then all of a sudden, from that point, 10 league games come along and you win 9 of them. What's that journey like, sort of seeing players perhaps get a few little doubts at the start of the season in their minds, because human beings are that way, they're wired that way, if you like, to then go on this sort of roller coaster run which projects you right up there to the near the top of the table?
Yeah, so it's a funny one. We had a really good pre-season, which, as you guys know, doesn't always
you're looking around thinking, Something's going to go wrong.
Exactly that. So we played QPR and it was beat them 5-0 and we'd beaten Swansea 1-0, but played really, really well, to be fair. And that, given off the back of last season where the club was at, it obviously created a huge expectation going into the Cambridge game, which Cambridge is a really tough place to go. You know, Mark Bonner's a really good coach that gets them well organised, well set up, carry some real threats. So expectation was really high going to Cambridge, I think. And our job was to try and keep it quite level. So actually, my thing after the game against Cambridge was this could be the best thing for us. A little bit of a reality check, a little bit of a slap round the face of don't get carried away with anything. And again, I think that's a big part of my role as well, is keeping the lads grounded and focused on the next one. Again, it becomes even harder in the world we're at now, but trying to avoid the external noise and concentrating on, it's such a marathon League One, that, you know, you're going to win games, you're going to lose games. Let's be honest around that. It's only where we're at come the end of the season. And the only thing you can do with that is game to game. So we do a lot around, you know, for me, I'm quite big on psychology, performance psychology. So I think we have a set of performance behaviours that, you know, we work really hard to create and develop. So things like discipline, intensity, bravery and focus are kind of our four. And I think what emotion is a barrier to those potentially. So for me, we all have a controllable range of emotion that allows us to keep our behaviours optimal. Sometimes when you step out of that controllable range, your behaviours suffer. And we do a lot. It's not about not being emotional. It's about the second you step out, how quickly can you bring it back down so that you stay present in the game? And I think that's in-game performance, but also game-to-game. You know, if you win a game or you win two games and you think you've cracked it and you're high as anything, yeah, your behaviours, you know, you come off at 2% in League One and you're up against it. Because I do think, you know, the level is some really, all the teams are really honest. I have to say that's the big thing the challenge you face. Everyone's so honest. Teams are, you know, are getting well coached now, are well organised. So if you're not at it, if you're not right and you think you've cracked it, then you'll quickly get a rude awakening.
It's Maidenhead at the weekend. Does that fall into that category of potential pitfalls of staying in that kind of framework of making sure that the team are focused, because it's the FA Cup and, as you know, anything can happen?
Yeah, definitely that. And that's the beauty of the competition, right? It's why we all love it so much. But it comes back to what I just spoke about. It's all in the behaviours for me. If we go into the game focusing on the outcome, for me, we're in trouble straight away. It's around the actions in game that will get you that. So make sure we focus on all the basics. Make sure we focus on our behaviours. You know, be extremely difficult to beat, and obviously go and try and control and dominate the game that we want to. So that whether you're playing Maidenhead, whether you're playing Man City, for me, we go through the same process. I think that's for me the way that you have to work. You don't do anything differently, you know, depending on who you're playing. So we'll be, you know, consistent in the approach. The message will be the same, and it is on us. I think that's the biggest bit. We have to control us and what we're able to do.
The great thing with this, Liam, is you managed to give me pointers to make sure I keep commentators and co-hosts in check, making sure their behaviours are absolutely spot on. And there was a nice mild bit of Cockney bashing as well with regards to lads from London and how you deal with them. So I'll keep those in mind moving forward as well. I mean, Liam, we appreciate your time, mate. We know it was a late finish last night up in Lincolnshire. And if anyone's watching this, he looks bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I'm sure you'll all agree. So management really does suit you, my friend. Thank you so much for joining us here on the EFL podcast. And not talking about people looking tired, but David Stowell as well. Thank you so much for joining us as a co-host, mate, once again.
I always look tired, mate. That's just how I am. But it brightens my day working with you. There you are.
Welcome to the... I was about to say welcome to the 40 Club, but Liam's nowhere near it, so he can go off today and smile and just enjoy himself being in his 30s. Liam, thank you again so much, my friend.
No, good to talk and really appreciate having me on. Thank you.
So that's it. Another episode done. A big thank you to Liam Manning, David Stowell, and Blackburn's Andrew Moran. As always, if you've enjoyed it, and I'm really sure you have done, then please do give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button, and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's David Prutton, and I'll see you same time next week for another episode of the official EFL podcast.